Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Stem cell researchers are scrambling to understand the implications of a ruling from a federal judge in Washington. The judge ruled yesterday that President Obama was wrong to allow federal funding for experiments conducted with new lines of stem cells derived from unused embryos from fertility clinics. Dr. Douglas Melton of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute says the ruling will slow down research on illnesses such as cancer, diabetes, and Parkinson's.
I would say it's a setback for patients who were very hopeful after Obama's decision to reverse the previous restrictions.
President Bush had limited research to existing stem cell lines only, but the judge yesterday wrote that in 1996, Congress unambiguously banned federal funds from being spent on any research in which human embryos are destroyed. Joining us on the line is Laura Meckler. She's covering the story for The Wall Street Journal. And Laura, this ruling is a temporary injunction, but does that mean that federal money can't go towards research done even on the existing stem cell lines that President Bush said were okay?
Well, that's a good question. It's one that researchers are trying to figure out right now, and folks at the National Institutes of Health, which oversees all of this research, are also trying to figure out. As of yesterday, they really didn't know exactly what was going to happen, whether money that's already out the door has to be, essentially that research has to be halted, or whether just no new grants can be issued. It's also not clear. Specifically, the judge didn't say whether his ruling would apply to the Bush rules because it was just the Obama rules that were before him. But most people's read of his ruling suggests that it would apply to those lines as well.
And what about what's going on in labs right now? What are you hearing from researchers who are in the midst of research using stem cells?
Right. Well, they're very concerned, and researchers as a whole are very supportive of stem cell research. They think it shows promise for, as you said, a number of diseases, and they're very disappointed in the ruling. Some of them are concerned about what's going to happen to their own research. There's just a lot of question marks out there right now.
But even Ron Stoddart, the executive director of Nightlight Christian Adoptions, which had originally been part of this lawsuit, said he would be surprised if the judge's ruling led to a complete ban on embryonic stem cell research. Do you think there's any chance that the ruling might be overturned?
Yes. I mean, it's always possible it could be overturned. It's the research community is pressuring the Justice Department heavily to appeal this ruling. And even if the temporary injunction stays, it still needs to be the actual underlying issue needs to be decided by this judge, who, of course, has sort of indicated where he's coming from on the issue, but then it could be appealed up to an appeals court. So, yes, this issue could make its way through the courts, but there's sort of a separate track going, too, which is that Congress could act if it wants to. In the past, Congress has had big majorities in favor of stem cell research. In 2006 and 2007, they passed legislation to allow the research to go forward. President Bush vetoed both of those bills, and they did not have enough of a majority to override that veto. Obviously, in today's environment, they could pass legislation allowing the research to go forward, and President Obama would certainly be expected to sign it. But it's a little bit of a wrinkle, because what the lawmakers were trying to do at the time and what President Obama was trying to do when he signed his executive order last year was to sort of draw a line, and it's sort of a moral line, and say, okay, federal money will not be used to destroy embryos, but federal money can be used to research with those embryos that have already been destroyed using private money. What the judge said was, you can't do that. The federal law has to say, if you're going to fund this research, you're funding research that destroys embryos. And he was having none of this separation. So Congress has to decide whether it's willing to go ahead and make that clear.
And it's an election year, so Congress might not want to step into all of that. What are the chances, do you think, that the Obama administration would look at federal policy again and try to address this through legislation when we've got elections coming up?
Right. That kind of could cut both ways, because in one sense, it just takes them away from the economy. The number one issue for most voters is the economy, and anything that takes candidates talking about something else is not helpful for the Democrats. That's sort of the conventional wisdom. On the other hand, stem cell research is very popular. Big majorities support it, polling has found in the past, and this could be an issue, that actually cuts the Democrats' way in a year that is looking pretty grim for them. So there may be some advantage to Democrats to keeping this issue alive.
The two researchers who sued claim unfair competition, that their research on adult stem cells would be unfairly affected by allowing federal money to also go to embryonic stem cells. Is that hard to prove, or aren't all grants competitive anyway?
Well, there are a limited number of dollars, for sure. So, and if you look at the NIH funding charts where you see how much money is spent, they do lump all stem cell research, adult and embryonic, into one line item, and then they break it down in terms of where each of it is going. So the numbers do get put together to some extent.
What's likely to happen from here?
So this issue is also going to continue to make its way through the courts. It's likely that the Obama administration will appeal this ruling, so we'll have to see what happens as it moves through the system there. We're also going to look at Congress, where there will be calls to change the policy, which they certainly have the power to do if they want to. And at the same time, I'll be looking to see what happens on the political campaigns to see if it becomes an issue, and if so, who it's benefiting.
Laura Meckler is a staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you.
You bet.
This year in the United States, at least six mosque projects have faced bitter opposition. But that news mostly flew under the radar until the furor over the planned Islamic Center blocks from Ground Zero erupted. These controversies also tend to obscure the fact that there are already nearly 2,000 mosques in the United States, many of them little more than makeshift prayer rooms in shops and offices. So is America Islamophobic? That's the question on the cover of this week's Time magazine. Bobby Ghosh is the magazine's deputy international editor, and he joins us from Time's studio in New York. And Bobby, I know you didn't write that headline, but I have to ask you that question. Is America Islamophobic?
As a nation and as a society, the answer is no. But there is a lot of Islamophobia that is growing in this country. It's spreading. It is becoming louder. And with the controversies over all these mosques, it now seems to have come into the mainstream in a very pronounced and very vicious way.
The recent Time magazine poll that found that around 20% of Americans think President Obama is a Muslim also found that nearly 50% of the people surveyed believe Islam is more likely to encourage violence against non-believers. Do you think these are people drawing a line directly from 9/11 to that percentage?
I'm sure that there is a certain number of people who do draw that line, not just from 9/11, but also from more recent terrorist attacks and potential attacks from American Muslims. For instance, Major Hassan at Fort Hood, Faisal Shahzad, the man who tried to bomb Times Square in New York. I'm sure that people look at this with a certain amount of alarm. But what also adds to that sense of fear is a widespread lack of knowledge about Islam. There is a tendency, and this tendency is encouraged by opportunistic politicians, there's a tendency to conflate these specific acts of terror with the whole religion, as if all of Islam promotes terrorism, as if all Muslims are potential terrorists. And that conflation is a very dangerous combination, and you light a match of politics in the middle of that, and you get a combustion, which is what we are seeing now.
You remind us that Islamophobia here in the U.S., if you believe it exists or is on the rise, still doesn't approach the level seen in other countries where Muslims are a minority.
Well, that is something that's worth celebrating. It is a testament to the melting pot of America that many Muslims, in fact, the majority of Muslims who live in this country and who have been polled, say that they are happy here, that they feel freer here to practice their religion. And the United States is certainly not like some countries in Europe. There are no politicians here who are proposing a ban on a particular kind of Islamic dress. There are no politicians, as in Switzerland, for instance, who are proposing a complete ban on all minaret construction. And there are no neo-Nazi thugs who are wandering in the streets and beating up Muslims in this country. And those are all things that are reassuring and need to be celebrated. But the fact is that there are a lot of angry voices who speak against Islam, who misrepresent it. And those voices are growing stronger, are growing angrier, and they have found common cause with people from mainstream American politics. And that is a dangerous combination. I think what we've learned from history, particularly in places like Europe, is that the leap from hate speech to hate crime is not a very large leap. And if we are not careful, then we could potentially see that happening in this country.
And as you write in your article, a lot of that hate speech is online. What are the misrepresentations about Islam that they're making?
Well, the biggest misrepresentation is that all Muslims are somehow one, that there is one large global community, all of whom think the same way, behave the same way, believe the exact same things. That is not true. There are 1.5 billion Muslims. There are several different sects within Islam, and within each sect, there are different schools of thought. It is a very, very diverse community. And American Muslims, in fact, are probably the most diverse Muslim community in the world, because you have people here who have come to this country from all over the world, not just from the Middle East, not just from South Asia, but Muslims from Europe, for instance. In our story, you meet a group of Bosnian Muslims who are having difficulty building a mosque in Sheboygan in Wisconsin. These are Europeans. And then from there, the next level of misconception is that because some terrorists are Muslim and claim to be performing these acts of terror in the name of Islam, it naturally must follow that Islam is a religion that encourages this kind of thing. That is far from true. Again, there are 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. If Islam was a religion that encouraged violence, this would be a much, much more violent world by definition.
What could Muslims do to fight those misrepresentations?
That is a concern that is being expressed more and more within the community. There is not a unified organization that can accurately claim to represent all American Muslims. And there is no single leader who can be the Martin Luther King of American Muslims. And this is a problem. This is a problem that the community is grappling with. How do we communicate our message? Who communicates our message for us? And they are very alarmed to see that a moderate religious figure like Imam Faisal Rauf, the man behind this project in New York, finds himself being attacked from all sides as being an extremist, as being pro-Al-Qaeda, which couldn't possibly be farther from the truth. So when a figure like this finds himself being pilloried in this manner, it becomes very hard for other Muslims to stand up and speak out.
And do you think it's made more difficult, this not having a central leader, some one person who speaks for Islam, by the fact that, as you point out in your article, fewer than 40% of Americans say they even know someone who is a Muslim?
That is a big part of the problem. Because it's such a small community, most Americans go through their lives or go through their days without encountering a Muslim. And sometimes I'm sure encounter a Muslim without really realizing it. That means that there are not a lot of the discussion about Islam in American households is not well informed, or is informed by what people see on the news. And in the news, unfortunately, Islam is often presented in the context of violence and terrorism in various parts of the world. So I have a suspicion, I don't know this for a fact, but I have a suspicion that Americans who do know Muslims, who have Muslims in their community and among their friends, are probably much less alarmed by the prospect of having a mosque either in downtown New York or in their own neighborhoods.
Bobby Ghosh is Deputy International Editor for Time Magazine, speaking to us about his cover story, Is America Islamophobic? More with him after a break. And later in the show, food policy expert Marion Nessel on the egg recall. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Bobby Ghosh. He wrote the cover story for the New Time magazine. The story is headlined, Is America Islamophobic? A question some people might say is worth asking in light of the furious debate that surrounds a proposed Islamic center in Lower Manhattan, just blocks from Ground Zero. And Bobby, you write that there are several other projects like this across the country that have generated opposition. You mentioned one of them before the break. It's in the Midwest. Tell us about that.
Well, this is a small community of Bosnian and Albanian Muslims in Sheboygan in Wisconsin, and a Pakistani-born doctor who lives in that community wanted to build a mosque in rural farmland on the outskirts of town. And our story begins at the town planning committee meeting where the doctor is not expecting any great opposition to his project because it is in the outskirts of town. He is he believes a well-liked figure in the community. Many people in the community are his patients. And yet when he arrives at this meeting, he is appalled to discover that one after the other, people at this meeting stand up and denounce his faith. They call Islam a violent religion. There is a person who claims that there are 20 jihadi training camps that are distributed all over the United States where another generation of terrorists are being trained even as we speak. This kind of quite venomous outpouring, and the doctor is horrified and stunned by it. I'm glad to report that particular story ends well. In the end, the town planning committee disregarded all of these opinions and gave the Muslim community permission to build a mosque. That process is actually taking place as we speak. Eventually, the community, both Muslim and not Muslim, would be united in a tragedy that took place near Sheboygan. A young Muslim family was holidaying on the shores of Lake Michigan. Their daughter disappeared, and both Muslims and non-Muslims in that community united to try and help the rescue effort. And there was a reaching out that took place from the non-Muslims to the Muslims. So in that example, the America's better angels came to the fore, and a very difficult situation was hopefully resolved for good. But unfortunately, as our reporting suggests, that many other parts of this country, not least in New York, those better angels are not to be seen.
So what does that one story say to you? That there's reason for optimism regarding relations between Americans and Muslims in the U.S.?
There is reason for optimism. But I think what we've learned in the past few weeks is that it will take leadership. It will take acts of statesmanship from our political leaders to try and turn down the temperature in our national discussion on Islam and Muslims, and to try and find reason and reasonable discourse.
George W. Bush went to a mosque soon after 9/11, making a statement, a powerful statement with that. And yet President Barack Obama hasn't been to an American mosque. Do you think he should go to one?
Well, he has visited a couple of mosques on his foreign trips, I think one in Cairo and one in Turkey. He has not yet been to a mosque in this country, an American Muslim mosque. And many American Muslims regard that as surprising and disappointing. In this overheated political climate, I have a suspicion that he will not make a visit to a mosque, because that might only confirm in the minds of this, as our poll suggests, one in four Americans who think that he's a Muslim. And unfortunately, since that is regarded as a bad thing, it would be political poison for him. But I think it would probably be a good idea for the president to at some point visit an American mosque, if only to send the message, as George Bush did, that this is an American population and they deserve to be treated like Americans, and that their patriotism as a group is above reproach.
And what about the debate within the Muslim community over the New York Project? Are Muslims divided too?
Well, yes, they are divided, not on principle, but out of concern for what this project has become, the political ramifications of it. If they had their druthers, the vast majority of American Muslims would be in favor of having the mosque being, or the Islamic cultural center being built at the location that has been identified. But there are bound to be people within the community who are fearful, who worry that the anger that has been generated will lead to even greater hostility against them. So my suspicion is that many of the people within the Muslim community who have reservations about this project feel that way out of fear. And it's not reassuring that Americans of any faith should feel fearful about expressing themselves.
All this controversy is happening during Ramadan, one of the most holy months of Islam. Did Muslims you spoke to for this article talk about that and how it's affecting them?
Ramadan is a time when Muslims fast during the day, and in the evenings they get together for contemplation and to break their fast and for special prayers. What that means is that the community gathers in much more often than they would in normal times. So you have groups of Muslims who meet for dinner to break their fast and so on, which means conversations about the community and the difficulties that the community is facing. Those kinds of conversations are taking place every evening, and it heightens a sense of alarm and dismay. So the timing of this controversy in New York just couldn't be worse in that respect.
How do you think the controversy will play out in New York? What do you think is going to happen?
The big question is what Imam Faisal does when he comes back. He's been on this tour in the Middle East. He's said very little. Daisy Khan, his wife, has made a few appearances. When he comes back, I think he's going to be under enormous pressure, ironically, from the Democrats to move the site. And if he does, then that will set off a whole other spiral of discussion and debate. I think many Muslims would be very, very dismayed to if that were to happen. What I'm hoping for is, and I'm hoping against hope, is some statesmanship, frankly, that other political leaders follow the example of Mayor Bloomberg, who's really been outstanding on this issue.
Bobby Ghosh is Time Magazine's Deputy International Editor. Bobby, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, New Orleans, 5 years after Katrina. We'll look at what's known as the city's pain index. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, an American jazz musician's love affair with music from Iran, Turkey, and other faraway places. News is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England, and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. For some Arkansas students, the burden of paying for college just got lighter. Recently, 25,000 students received scholarships funded by proceeds from the state lottery. But the state coffers were only full enough to cover half of the students who qualified. This is the first year of Arkansas's scholarship lottery, and with us to talk about it is Jim Purcell, the director of the Department of Higher Education in Arkansas. And Dr. Purcell, explain this program to us. Where did this idea come from?
Well, it's based on a citizens' referendum to have all lottery proceeds, a new lottery scholarship fund. And we've got about $125 million to spend for this next year.
And the scholarships only cover students attending schools in Arkansas. What's the motivation behind that?
Well, Arkansas is about, 50th out of 51 if you count Washington, D.C., and the number of adults with a bachelor's. So we really wanted to inspire Arkansans to get a degree in Arkansas and stay here and help as we move into the more modern economy.
But there was a shortfall this year, right? What happened, it sounds like there wasn't enough money to cover all the people who applied, or did more people apply for the scholarship than you thought would apply?
The scholarship sort of is in three parts, and the students coming right out of high school, all those students were funded. The students that were currently in college who had some credits and been going full-time, they were all funded. But it's the students who are the non-traditional. There was a limited number of funds for those students, and certainly we had more demand than we had funds.
Why set aside less money for the non-traditional students?
Well, historically, scholarship funds in all states have always had priority for students coming right out of high school. And we're actually excited that we actually had allocated $41 million for students that were already in school and then another $12 million for students coming really from the workforce trying to upgrade their skills.
But aren't those non-traditional students seen to be better students? They're often older. They've gone out into the world, as you say. They've worked. They realize they need a higher degree to get further. They are often more committed and have better outcomes.
Absolutely, and I think that's why we made the consideration to make sure we could fund those. And I will say the governor has announced an additional $6 million that we're going to be adding to the fund so we can award more students that were on the waiting list.
But there'll still be some who won't get that money.
Absolutely.
With 54,000 students applying for the scholarship and only about 25,000 receiving awards, do you consider this a success so far, even though you've had to leave out half of the students who wanted and needed the money?
Right, absolutely a success. We went from 8,000 students receiving this academic challenge scholarship that is called last year with just state money, and now we're going to have over 25,000 students. So really, we've quadrupled the participation in the scholarship. So I think that is going to have an increase in degree production. We know that financial aid is a third of the reason students have issues as far as completing, so we do believe this will have an impact on our student success.
Now, what is the state doing to keep those students, to attract them to want to stay in Arkansas?
I think actually the scholarship does several things. One, if you have some folks that really want to have their kids to go to college, the way the scholarship's written now, if your kids are in high school and you've been a resident in Arkansas for a year, then your child would qualify for this scholarship. And for people coming right out of high school, your child gets to go to college with the $5,000 at a university or $2,500 at a community college. So one of them is just encouraging people to come to Arkansas because it's a good place to raise a family. The second is we know that there's a strong correlation between education and per capita income. And in order for Arkansas to increase our per capita income, we're going to have the workforce for which businesses will come and be attracted to.
Dr. Jim Purcell is director of the Department of Higher Education in Arkansas. And this reminder for some of our listeners today, it's primary day in several states. In Alaska and Arizona, two incumbent Republican senators are facing challenges. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska is being challenged by Joe Miller, who has the backing of Sarah Palin and the Tea Party. In Arizona, Senator John McCain is facing former congressman and radio talk show host J.D. Hayworth in today's primary. It's voting day in Florida, too. Two races getting a lot of attention there are the Republican primary race for governor and the Democratic primary for one of the state's U.S. Senate seats. In Vermont, there's a five-way Democratic primary for governor. And in Oklahoma, there's a hotly contested runoff election between two Republicans in the state's 5th congressional district. Political newcomer James Lankford faces former state representative Kevin Calvey. Both men are highlighting their conservative credentials, and the winner will face a Democrat and two independents in the general election in November. Up next, Marion Nessel on the egg recall. It's Here and Now. The salmonella outbreak has so far prompted the recall of over 500 million eggs nationwide, the largest egg recall in U.S. history, and more could come. The company at the heart of the recall, Wright County Egg in Iowa, is so huge that FDA investigators are still sifting through distribution records to see where the affected eggs ended up. Part of the recall also came from another Iowa egg producer, Hillendale Farms. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it's logged about 200 reported illnesses associated with this investigation. But the agency also suspects tainted eggs have sickened about 2,000 people since May. Joining us is Marion Nessel. She's professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University and the author of several books, including Food Politics and Safe Food. Marion, welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
Are you surprised by this outbreak and subsequent recall?
No, it's one that's just followed a pattern since the really big spinach recall of 2006. That was followed by pet food. That was followed by tomatoes, jalapeno peppers, endless meat recalls, and one food after another, all of them from the same suffering from the same problem, which is we don't have a food safety regulatory system in this country that works.
Right. So is this a case of the producer failing to follow the safety rules, or do the safety rules for egg production need to be strengthened?
Well, the safety rules for egg production were strengthened, but the strengthening didn't go into effect until July 9th this year. The FDA has been trying for years and years and years to get egg rules in place, but they've been strongly resisted by the industry, which would much rather do safety voluntarily. And that, of course, is the problem with all of the food safety issues, is that every time somebody wants to put some regulations in place that would level the playing field and force everybody to play by the same rules, the industry balks and says we can do it voluntarily. And each of these outbreaks is an example of what happens with voluntary.
As you mentioned, the FDA recently passed new regulations. Do you think if those regulations had taken effect earlier, it could have prevented this outbreak? And explain what those regulations are.
Well, we know how to produce eggs without salmonella. There have been plenty of examples of states that have instituted policies to reduce salmonella, and guess what? They work. But on the federal level, they don't work because they haven't been in place until now. And all they do is require the flocks to be clean of salmonella. You start with a clean flock. You make sure that your eggs are washed, but the salmonella could be on the inside, but they won't be if the flock is clean. And you keep the eggs cold. You test to make sure that everything is working the way it's supposed to, and your eggs are clean.
Pretty straightforward. But so far, traces of salmonella have not even been detected at either Wright County Egg or Hillendale Farms, even though eggs from their farms have been found to be tainted. We know that the FDA had never inspected either producer. Why wasn't there more oversight?
Well, because there were no rules that covered it. The FDA didn't have the authority to go in and do that. Its shell eggs rules went into effect July 9th this year. And the production of eggs, that is, the hens themselves, are under the Department of Agriculture's purview. And in my book, Safe Food, though, which is subtitled The Politics of Food Safety, I talk about how the different stages of egg production are all under different regulatory agencies. So it doesn't work.
Well,
Everybody leaves it up to everybody else, and that's why these egg rules were so important. And by the way, the FDA first proposed them in 2004, and they've been languishing in the Federal Register ever since. This is the first time that the FDA has been able to get them out of the Federal Register and into action.
So they've been trying, and it sounds like Congress is trying to do something as well. There's been a lot of talk about the Farm Bill, which passed the House, now sits in the Senate. And you say it's not a perfect step, but it's a good first step. What would it do?
Well, it's the Food Safety Bill. It's not the Farm Bill. It's a bill that will give the FDA the authority and resources it needs to do its job. That bill was passed by the House at the end of July last year, not this July, the one before, and the Senate has been sitting on it ever since. Why hasn't the Senate acted on it? Because there's so much industry opposition to it under the table, and the lobbyists are hard at work making sure that nothing happens. They want voluntary food safety procedures. I don't think voluntary food safety procedures work, and the egg recall is a very good example of why not.
And would that bill also give the FDA authority to make recalls mandatory?
It would give the FDA the authority to order recalls. Right now, the FDA has to go to the producers of unsafe food and say, please, pretty please, would you please recall your products? They don't have to.
You know, today the House Energy and Commerce Committee requested information about this outbreak and the egg recalls. Do you think there'll be congressional hearings about this? And what could we learn?
I hope so. I hope so. I don't know what it will take to get Congress to pass decent food safety legislation. The reason that I think this bill is imperfect, the main reason, there are some other reasons as well, but the main reason is that it only deals with the FDA's authority. What we really need is a single food agency that will bring the functions of the Department of Agriculture and the FDA together. But that is so politically far off and so impossible to even contemplate in today's political climate that the best Congress can come up with is fix the FDA. I think at least that's a good first step.
You know, the recalls in this case keep coming because the industry has dramatically consolidated over the past 20 years or so. Is this a problem?
Of course it is. The more animals you have in one place, the easier it is for infections to spread among them. I mean, it's really that simple. It's like when, you know, some of us were children hundreds of years ago, we were told not to go to public swimming pools because of polio. Remember that? That's gone. That threat is gone now, but it's exactly the same kind of problem. If you've got one sick bird in a place where you've got 150,000 birds running around or in cages, you're going to have a problem of spreading. And so it looks, you know, Washington Post today has a long article on consolidation in the egg industry, and this recall may be a wake-up call that maybe they need to have to downsize a little bit.
So you think this will lead to some reforms that sounds like this country needs?
I don't know whether it will or not. I don't know what it will take. We've had so many huge recalls in the last three or four years, and none of them have gotten Congress to move. I think we need a national uprising about it. I think the public should be appalled, horrified, and outraged that Congress hasn't acted on this.
Eggs leading to a possible uprising. Thank you so much. Marion Nessel is professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. You can link to her blog and a list of all egg recalls on our website, hereandnow.org. Welcome back. The London home of composer George Friedrich Handel is opening an exhibit about its other famous resident. During the late 1960s, the groundbreaking guitarist Jimi Hendrix lived in an apartment that is now part of the Handel House Museum, where the great composer lived during the 18th century. The Hendrix exhibit there is devoted to the rocker's London years. It includes film clips, recordings, handwritten lyrics, and his clothing. Jimi Hendrix died in London on September 18, 1970. To mark the 40th anniversary of his death next month, visitors will be able to tour the rooms where Hendrix lived, which are usually not open to the public. Jazzman Lloyd Miller is probably the only American musician to host a program on Iranian television. He did that in the 1970s while he was working on a doctorate in ethnomusicology. As a teenager, Miller and his family moved to Iran when his father took a job there in the late 1950s. And that's where his passion for jazz collided with the Persian music he came to love. The mixture resulted in a much sought-after disc among record collectors called Oriental Jazz, which was recorded in the 1960s. Now, on Miller's latest CD, on which he teams with the British fusion band The Heliocentrics, he offers listeners another mix of East and West. When the BBC's Andrew Purcell spoke with Lloyd Miller, the musician described how he discovered traditional Iranian music when he was a jazz-absorbed 19-year-old.
My father found this job in Iran, and all my friends said, "What's that?" And I says, "I don't know," and nobody could tell me where it was or what it was. And so off we went, and there we were. And I was so depressed, and no more jazz, oh, my life is over. We were at the hotel, and the first night they turned on the radio, and I heard some tar playing, and I said, "Hey, wow, this is the best of bebop, but played on something like a banjo." I'd already seen Japanese and Chinese in Hong Kong and Thai music and Indian music and Pakistani music on our way to Iran. We stopped at all those places, and everywhere I went, I said, "Wow, this is jazz with another feel." So I realized that jazz wasn't just American. It was worldwide, and it is worldwide.
What began that day in Tehran was a lifelong devotion to traditional Persian music. As a young adult, Miller travelled through Europe, playing in the clubs of Germany and France, searching for a way to assimilate Islamic melodies and chord changes with the American jazz that he grew up with. The result, ignored and misunderstood for many years, was Oriental jazz, now being rediscovered by a generation of open-minded musicians, among them the Heliocentrics. Heliocentrics drummer Malcolm Catto and bassist Jake Ferguson knew Miller's music well, but it was still a shock when, with a day's notice, they were asked to sit in on a session with him, as Ferguson explains.
So we went in there and it was, oh, this is Lloyd Miller. Oh, hi, Lloyd. How you doing? Love your music. And I was going, yeah, you guys look kind of groovy. We're going to have some fun, sort of thing, you know. Cut a long story short, Lloyd literally just counted it in, 1, 2, 3, 4, and we were off. And it was a case of just sort of listening to Lloyd, listening to each other, and trying to follow it, you know, and that's how that session came about. I mean, it's as live as you could get.
The session went well enough to set up another with a few invited guests. The only difficulty was that 1, 2, 3, 4 isn't something you hear very much in Miller's music, which tends to be in a 6-8 time signature, with an eastern swing that the heliocentrics weren't accustomed to. Miller says he was incredibly impressed by how fast they picked it up, but he couldn't shake the feeling that he was straining slightly against the beat.
The only problem I had was they were still stuck in their hip-hop groove, and they couldn't quite get away from that enough to really go into a different room and close the door. And that's kind of what you need to do to really do this right.
Miller has been studying Persian music for 60 years now. After his trip through Europe, he returned to Iran, taking the Iranian name Kurosh Ali Khan, hosting a popular radio show there and learning traditional instruments. On the heliocentrics collaboration alone, he plays piano, clarinet, oud, tar, sitar, santur, flute, shawm, vibraphone, and percussion.
But this is tuned sensibly. So the same fingering gets you everywhere, except you just remember to skip over to that because it's one sort of... Your fingers don't have to change hardly at all, so you can go faster. But anyway, this is the ancestor of the guitar and the mandolin and the ukulele and all kinds of instruments.
The album touches on Latin jazz and Afghan folk melodies. It visits Indonesia and the Middle East. But Miller's great love remains the music of Iran. And I asked him whether, with relations between the United States and Iran at such a low, he ever encounters hostility to the music where he lives in Salt Lake City, USA. He described a recent concert.
We played this beautiful music, and we told them it was from Iran, and this one's from Afghanistan, and this other is from Uzbekistan, and this one's from Turkey. And there was no animosity at all in the audience against the culture and the arts. We haven't seen that yet. I saw a lot more of that during the hostage crisis than I'm seeing right now.
Miller believes in playing jazz and Islamic music side by side, without altering traditional melodies, harmonies, and rhythms for the sake of fusion or modernity. In this sense, he's something of a fundamentalist. He can't stand the Beatles, hates modern jazz, and he worries that valuable musical traditions are being overwhelmed.
These things are being eroded and erased by this modernization that's becoming too electronic and too inhuman. If 50% of the music was the sort of jumpy, jittery, and then 50% was something else, whether it was Indian tabla and sitar, or whether it was Korean screaming with chango, or whether it was beautiful Balinese, or whatever. Just something different, so it's fair. 50-50, not 99 9/10% of pop junk and the rest not even happening anymore, just like almost gone from the face of the earth.